Gold prices are down, but that's okay, really. Your car can be hacked, which is really not okay. And rural America is sick and tired and not gonna take it anymore. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday. This one is the 21st of July. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. It's been a while since we have talked commodities on this program, apart, I mean, from the occasional mention of oil, I suppose. But commodities today, we are going to do specifically gold. It's been a rough couple of days for the original precious metal. It dropped to a five-year low on Monday because why? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson gets us going.
Here's a rather delightful summary of what's up with gold.
Gold has totally fallen out of bed over the last couple of days.
That charming turn of phrase comes from Colin Szyzinski with CMC Markets.
There's a number of factors that drive gold up and down over time, and at the moment, all of them, the pendulum has swung to being a headwind for gold rather than a tailwind.
You see, people buy gold in times of uncertainty. It's supposed to be a safe haven and a hedge against inflation. But inflation fears are now down, and from Greece to Iran, things are looking up. Speaking of up, that's where U.S. interest rates are likely headed. That also puts pressure on gold, says Campbell Harvey. He's a finance professor at Duke.
It's like we have turned the corner that there's going to be continued growth in the future and the interest rates can go back to normal levels. All of this implies that there's less risk, there's less fear, there's less reason to hoard gold.
Harvey says another factor is recent news that China's been buying less gold for its reserves than previously thought. Lower demand, lower prices. Eric Norland is an economist at the CME Group, a derivatives exchange. He says gold just doesn't have a lot of uses.
The other precious metals like platinum, palladium, and silver, they have very extensive industrial uses. So for silver, a great deal of it is used in electronics, etc.
Norland says lots of gold just sits in vaults as an investment. So when you take away fear, you take away a big reason to buy gold. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The number of the day today is 16. It's not a stock or a market share or an economic indicator of any kind. Ohio Governor John Kasich entered the race for the GOP presidential nomination today, the 16th person to do so, as you know. There are five on the Democratic side, some of which on both sides are, to be honest, long shots. You know who they are. They do, too. So here with a question. Why are they running when the odds are so heavily stacked against them? Marketplace's Nova Sappho takes a stab at the answer.
First of all, long shots do win sometimes.
I mean, our current president being an example of one where somebody comes out of nowhere.
That's Lance Strait. He's a professor of communication and media studies at Fordham University. But why so many long shot candidates in this election cycle? Strait says one reason is that the internet and social media have changed the calculus.
A political campaign can get started with a relatively small amount of resources to begin with and then take off.
So the buy-in is low. The rewards, though, can be high, says Larry Sabatow, who heads the University of Virginia's Center for Politics, even if a candidate doesn't win.
You can increase your speaking fees. You may very well be offered a TV or radio contract.
For example, Mike Huckabee reportedly made $500,000 a year for his Fox News show. Herman Cain got a nationally syndicated radio program. And those speaking fees? They can reach tens of thousands of dollars.
I mean, think about that. An hour-long speech, some Q&A, and you walk away with a check for 50 or 60 grand.
Sabatow says this kind of brand building isn't new, just intensified. He can point back to when presidential candidate Barry Goldwater chose a relatively unknown Republican congressman, Bill Miller, as his VP. They lost. Miller made an American Express commercial.
I ran for Vice President of the United States in 64, so I shouldn't have trouble charging a meal, should I? Why, with this, they treat me as though I'd won.
Miller made that commercial a full 11 years after his turn in the political spotlight. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Apple reported earnings after the bell today, added to an already grim day on Wall Street. Details, numbers, you know the drill. There was, in a kind of relative sense, I guess, some good news about the Greek economy today. Standard & Poor's, the credit rating people, raised Greece's rating today from triple C minus to triple C plus, or in layman's terms, from really, really terrible to just slightly less terrible. Tonia Korka is one of the people that we met while we were over there last week. She's a part-time research associate at the Hellenic Institute of International and Foreign Law in Athens. But more to the point for our purposes here, she is a person living in a really, really troubled economy. Tonia, it's good to speak with you again. How are you?
I am fine.
Tell me, would you, what it's been like since the last time we spoke, which was a week or 10 days ago, now that the bailout has sort of started and the banks are open again?
Yeah, we have a lot of things going on here in Greece. Since yesterday, the banks are open, but they are not open. They are open, but you can only put money in your account. You cannot withdraw. So the cash limit, 60 euros, is still the same. So I don't know what is going to happen.
Yeah. You know, Tonia, when we were there a week ago, one of the things that I got out of our conversation, you and I, was that you, you know, working two or three jobs without even 60 euro in the bank that you could get out, that you had, in a way, given up. And you were just holding on for your son. Your son is 13, okay, right?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Is it still that way, do you think? Is the mood still bad?
Yeah, it's still like that. We are hoping that something is going to change because we cannot do anything else. But unfortunately, when I hear about the measures and what they promise, I see that there is still the same culture. We protect the public servants and the public sector, but the private sector is not our priority. And I can't understand how they are thinking that the economy is going to grow again if they don't give some motives to have a transaction. I don't know. It's crazy.
Is the economy still basically the big thing that everybody talks about over there?
Yes, yes, yes. You can hear it all over in streets. People are walking and talking about what's going on with the banks. You hear it. It's all around you when you walk.
Can we call you in a couple of weeks and see how you're doing?
Yes, of course. It would be a pleasure for me, of course.
All right, good. Well, maybe we'll come back to Athens and see, and I'll buy you another cup of coffee. How about that?
Yeah, that would be nice. But I hope that you had the chance in a normal situation so that we would enjoy our coffee. Okay.
All right. Thank you, Tonia.
Okay, Kyle. Thank you.
The stereotypical story goes like this, right? A person grows up out in the boonies someplace, leaves after high school or maybe college, moves to the big city, and lives happily ever after. But you know what? Rural America is sick and tired of it and not going to take it anymore. Those states have a whole lot of jobs, often without the skilled workers needed to fill them. So places like Wyoming and South Dakota and Idaho have started their own matchmaking programs to convince their expats to come back home. Wyoming Public Radio's Miles Bryan has the story.
Meet Max Salzberg.
How's it going? I'm Max.
Max is 37, married, and works in marketing. He and his wife, Sonia, live in Fort Collins, Colorado, a bustling small city filled with breweries and bike aficionados. But Max grew up about an hour away from here, in the much smaller town of Cheyenne, Wyoming.
I thought it was small and lame and boring.
As soon as he finished school, Max left for city life in Colorado, and he's been here ever since. That's pretty common. Young people who grew up in rural areas move away from home at a rate 3.5 times higher than their city counterparts.
I wanted to be able to go to shows. I wanted to be able to go to art museums and all of that.
But now Max and his wife are thinking about a baby soon, and maybe a move. So how do you convince young people like Max to give up this? For this. Well, by getting a little assertive.
Are you looking for a better way of life? One where the skies are blue, the air is fresh, and the opportunities are limitless?
Yeah, that's a robocall. Not usually very persuasive, but this one brings out the big guns.
I'm South Dakota Governor Dennis Dugard, and I invite you to follow your roots back home.
The employment matchmaking program South Dakota Roots lets moms or high school buddies sign up their lost loved ones to be contacted by a job recruiter who tries to place them back in the Mount Rushmore state.
We have thousands of immediate job openings from our state's top employers.
South Dakota Roots has had some limited success. About 15% of those who get signed up end up back home. Now, a couple of other states are following its lead. Wyoming's program doesn't have a robocall, but you do get a letter from the governor.
So here's the text of it.
Haley McKee works for the state and helped set up Wyoming's program.
Thank you for visiting the Wyoming Grown website and for expressing interest in relocating to Wyoming. More?
McKee says Wyoming Grown got started after the state ran the numbers and realized 60% of young people left Wyoming within 10 years of finishing high school. She says, sure, a lot of those young people are not going to give up city life for the open prairie.
But for those people who want to come back, who are familiar with Wyoming, I feel pretty confident that we're making some strides here.
So how do you zero in on who actually wants to come back? Here's a hint.
A strategy of trying to attract back people who are in their 30s and had children probably has the best possible chance of success.
Ken Johnson studies rural population change at the University of New Hampshire. He says there is a minor trend, emphasis on the minor, of 30-somethings going back to their rural homes. The ones who do are usually at the point in their lives when they care less about good bars and more about good schools.
Maybe it's not the best job in the world, but maybe it's a good job. And, you know, maybe that's enough to push somebody who is kind of sitting on the fence to think about coming back.
Max Salzberg's parents are hoping Max will jump off that fence. They encouraged him to sign up for Wyoming Grown, but Max insists they are leaving it up to him.
If they hear that I was like, yeah, they're totally pressuring me, my mom would be really mad about that. She'd be like, we are not pressuring you.
Max says he's still undecided about moving, but
if we had kids and there was a good job and we could move to somewhere in Wyoming where they have decent schools mostly, and I mean, yeah, my childhood was boring. I want that for my child.
Whether his kid will stick around is another question. In Fort Collins, Colorado, I'm Miles Bryan for Marketplace.
Coming up.
They didn't actually tell me what they were going to do. They just said, go ahead and drive on the highway, Andy. We'll demonstrate our attacks.
Ends just about as badly as you'd think it would. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 1% today, 181 points, 17,919. The NASDAQ reversed itself 0.2%, 10 points, 5208. The S&P 500 forfeited 0.4%, 9 points, 2119. IBM and United Technologies delivered the 1-2 punch to the Dow today. UT plunged 7% after reporting not only a bad quarter, but more trouble ahead. Big Blue got hit hard after yesterday's revelation that earnings were down for the 13th straight quarter. Do the math, that's 4-plus years, yo. Company shares the lead in nearly 6% today. All right, so Apple, here we go. First of all, no numbers on the watch. CEO Tim Cook told CNBC sales did exceed expectations, but in true Apple fashion, he did not say what the expectations were. Oh yeah, earnings. iPhone sales up 35%. Earnings beat expectations, this being capitalism, however. Shares down around 7% after the bell. I love it when that happens. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy. From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for June. On July 22, 1934, notorious bank robber John Dillinger was shot and killed by federal agents in Chicago. And a storm is on the horizon. The forecast calls for Sharknado 3, Oh Hell No, airing on Sci-Fi. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. If you're trying to get from L.A. to points east on Interstate 10, say Arizona, you're out of luck for the foreseeable future. A huge storm out here this weekend literally washed away part of the highway. There is some talk it could reopen soonish, but in the meanwhile, as Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports, the lost dollar signs are piling up.
The bridge that collapsed was in a remote stretch of desert highway, but it's a key passageway for truckers hauling consumer goods from Asia out of California ports.
You know, I-10 is a major east-west corridor between, you know, California and certainly to Texas and other places in between.
Rob Field runs the Economic Development Agency for Riverside County in California. He says state transportation officials are pledging to soon reopen the part of the bridge that's still standing to two-way traffic. Field says the longer the bridge is closed, the greater the economic pain.
Hard to put a dollar value on it without doing some, you know, some real drilling down, but it's significant. I mean, we're talking millions of dollars in impact, not, you know, hundreds of thousands.
Every day, about 7,000 trucks pass over the span. So says the head of the Arizona Trucking Association, Tony Bradley. He says it's no easy task to reroute trucks while the bridge is out of commission. Bradley says the closest options might add as much as 3 hours to a trip. There are essentially no local roads that trucks can use. That means higher fuel and labor costs. Truckers get paid by the mile.
So we're looking at about $1.3 million a day just in because of the added miles.
But even if the bridge reopens this week, John Benoit has concerns about bigger economic effects. He's the 4th District Supervisor in Riverside County, California.
We are very, very concerned that other bridges maybe are even in more serious condition than this one, and that the entire infrastructure of our highway system is in arrears.
Benoit says California needs a long-term solution for funding that infrastructure. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
A couple of years ago, one of the many times that things got dicey in Egypt, I had a chat with a shopkeeper in Cairo named Imad Nour Hafez about how all the political instability there was affecting his tourist business. There have been plenty of ups and downs in Egypt since then, but tourism has never really bounced back to where it was pre-Arab Spring. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams recorded that interview I did with Imad. She went back not too long ago to see how he's getting by.
Everything okay?
Imad Nour Hafez's welcome is just as warm and his shop just as chocked full of handmade jewelry boxes and pen holders as it was the first time I visited. But Cairo's Khan al-Khalili Bazaar, though still busy on a weekend evening, is very different. My friend and I are the only foreigners in sight.
I changed my life completely because 4 years now, no tourists. I have a family, I have kids, I have my parents also. So now I do it double power to live.
Even working two times as hard, Hafez says his monthly income dropped by half since before 2011 and is just now slowly starting to creep back up. And it's not because of sales in his shop, even though Egypt's tourism numbers have recovered a bit.
Before, all the customers come to me.
He does still get some customers, locals coming in to order custom arabesque-style furniture, but most of his tourist stuff gets exported in bulk to Europe and to Gulf countries. Changing the way he does business hasn't been easy or cheap.
I must pay it for shipping. I must pay it for taxes. There is cargo from my shop to airport, you know. There is a lot of things.
Before the revolution, when he was only exporting 20% of his products, those taxes and shipping costs weren't that bad. But now it's reversed, and he exports 80% of his merchandise. And Hafez isn't the only one. He introduces me to a fellow shopkeeper just across the courtyard. Mohamed El Zouali sells hand-cast and etched pots and lanterns polished on machines just around the corner.
Before, if you produced 1,000 pieces, you'd sell 200 to 300 in your shop and export the rest. Now, if you produce the 1,000 pieces, you have to export them all.
But he's not too worried, since he still gets custom orders for lights and fixtures from local businesses and has a stable of European customers who buy his goods in bulk.
I'm a producer. I know where to put my products. The man whose shop is closed now, he used to rely on souvenirs. Now, of course, in the times we're living, there are no customers, so things have stopped for him.
Across the courtyard, Imad Hafez says the only way for businesses like his to survive is to be flexible. As evidence of what happens when you're not, he references the hundreds of shuttered shops in the bazaar.
They stopped in the same place. They're still waiting the tourists. It's okay, and the tourist doesn't come.
Hafez thinks the new military-backed government will lure tourists back to pre-revolution levels, but he's going to keep focusing on exports for now, just in case. I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The Security and Privacy in Your Car Act, yes, the Spy Car Act, was introduced in the United States Senate today. Among the things the bill is meant to do, according to its sponsors, is protect your car from being hacked, taken over, in other words, by people who aren't you, the driver. Andy Greenberg writes about what it's like to be in a car that's been hacked in the new Wired magazine. Andy, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me here.
I will tell you what, man, this is a crazy piece. And you know how I knew that?
How did you know?
I knew it because right up in the top of the story, it has one of these hackers saying to you, no matter what happens, don't panic.
That should have been my cue to start panicking immediately, probably.
That's right. You volunteered as a guinea pig for this hacking a car experiment. Give me the bare bones here.
Right. So Charlie Miller and Chris Valasek are two security researchers, and for the last 3 years, they've been working on building what is called in the security industry an exploit, a tool to compromise an automobile from a wireless internet connection. They got me to drive this car on the highway. They didn't actually tell me what they were going to do. They just said, go ahead and drive on the highway, Andy. We'll demonstrate our attacks.
So let's run down those. You're driving 70 miles an hour on a highway outside St. Louis, and then what starts to happen?
So first, the vents just started blasting on full. I hadn't touched the dashboard at all, and like cold air is filling the car. Then the radio switched stations and started blaring at full volume on the hip-hop station. It was Ski-Lo, I believe. And then the two hackers appeared in an image on the dashboard screen.
Wow.
Then the windshield wipers started going back and forth and spraying wiper fluid, kind of obscuring my vision on the highway. And then they cut my transmission entirely, and I couldn't put the car in drive.
So you hit the gas pedal and nothing happened?
Right. The accelerator had been disabled, and the car just kind of slowed to a crawl. You know, there were cars piling up behind me. I did feel what it's like to have your car hacked.
They did this remotely. They did it wirelessly, right? Is that that's the big thing?
Right. They did it over the internet. So they could have done this anywhere on Sprint's network. These vehicles have a computer feature called Uconnect that uses Sprint's network to, you know, for navigation and entertainment. Every Uconnect from a certain year, the end of 2013, a little bit of the beginning of 2015, is potentially vulnerable. And they're suggesting that everybody go update their software immediately.
They're doing it, I guess, to prove a point, right? They're doing it because they can, but also they want to make sure everybody understands the vulnerabilities here with cars that are basically as connected as smartphones.
They say that their first priority is to inform the research community. But they also, I believe, are sending a message to the industry that this is a serious issue, that they need to start thinking about the fact that their cars have hackable bugs that they should be fixing, just like Google and Microsoft focus on every day. And also to consumers who need to know that some cars may be more hackable than others, and they need to hold the industry accountable, you know, with their dollars.
You called Chrysler, right?
Oh, of course.
And they said?
Well, to be clear, the researchers called Chrysler way back in October and have worked with them for months to release a patch, which Chrysler very quietly released with no explanation of what it was until, you know, until our story made clear that you have to install this to protect yourself from a serious attack. But I also called Chrysler, of course, and they said, you know, we take this kind of thing very seriously. Yeah. But they also made some kind of side glance remarks about Charlie and Chris, the hackers, saying we appreciate their work, but we don't want anyone to see a kind of how-to so that these attacks could be replicated by more malicious hackers.
Well, and in fact, these two guys are going to release most of their findings at a Black Hat Hackers Conference coming up, right?
That's right. They're actually publishing the code that they use for this attack, but they're leaving out one part to make sure that some teenage kid in his basement isn't going to start taking over thousands of vehicles on real highways.
Can't leave you hanging out there on the highway with the gas pedal not working and a semi-truck bearing up behind you. How did you get out of this mess?
Well, I couldn't hear them as they said this, but Charlie and Chris were, because of course the radio was blasting, but Charlie and Chris were telling me that all I had to do was restart the vehicle. So the first time it didn't work, which was even more unnerving, but eventually, you know, it's true that even in the, for your car, you can solve these problems just by turning it off and on
again.
Turn
it off, turn it on again. That's right. Andy Greenberg is a senior writer at Wired Magazine. Andy, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with the observation that it was 5 years ago today that the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill was signed into law. Arguably, and many will on this point, the most fundamental changes to this country's banking system since the Great Depression. But that's not what I wanted to talk about. I want to talk about this. AEI, the American Enterprise Institute, is out with a 5-year retrospective of Dodd-Frank in which it reprises some old polling data from 5 years ago when the bill was being debated, including this question, and here you go. This is basically a quote. As you may know, Congress is working on major legislation dealing with the regulation of banks and financial institutions. Thinking about the issue, do you think legislation to regulate banks and financial institutions is A, interesting, or B, boring? 60% of people said banking regulations are interesting. First of all, who are those people? And second of all, no. No, they're not. It's my job, you guys, and I'm here to tell you they are not interesting. I'm going to get all kinds of letters about financial regulation after that one, I'm just saying. All right, the Dow off 1% today, 181 points. The NASDAQ reversed 0.2%, 10 points. The S&P 500 forfeited 0.4%, 9 points. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer around here is Nishat Kirwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. And oh yeah, this is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.